On To The Point, we try to make sense of the policy debates and the political sideshows on the campaign trail.
You have this kind of asymmetrical warfare coming from a guy who's great at a soundbite, lousy at an answer.
So are you looking for your own billionaire?
Nope. No, I don't want my own billionaire. I'm going to raise the vast majority of the money.
Brace yourself, America, for what?
King Trump.
I'm Warren Olney. To The Point has you covered for the 2016 campaign. Find the To The Point podcast on KCRW's iTunes page.
From KCRW Santa Monica and KCRW.com, it's The Treatment. Welcome to The Treatment. I'm Elvis Mitchell. My guest, composer and musician Cliff Martinez, maybe one of the few people who saw the Beatles and instead of buying a guitar, he got a set of drums. You may know him from the first Red Hot Chili Peppers album, or Freaky Styley, or the theme from Killer Clowns from Outer Space.
I've got a ringtone in iOS 7, and that's a top secret, but I think that may be the thing that I will be most remembered by.
Really? That more than Drive, or more than Traffic, or well, Sex, Lies, and Videotape?
Well, think how many people have an iPhone.
Well, Cliff's newest film as composer with Nicholas Winding Refn is the film Neon Demon. First of all, thanks so much for being here.
My pleasure.
And the thing I find myself thinking about so much when I see your films is you put a lot of music. I mean, there's a lot of score in the films you do, isn't there?
It's getting that way. The first film I did, Sex, Lies, and Videotape, had exactly 20 minutes of music, which was like one piece of music per reel back when they divided the film.
What is this thing you say?
Yeah,
this
I know.
Reel you speak of?
All right, back in the old days, some of the older folks have probably told you about the reels. But back then, I thought that was the way films were done, and I always expected to do 20 minutes of music in films ever since, and now it's like 50, 60 minutes.
Well, for the Nick, the Soderbergh series for Cinemax, you do a lot of music for that.
Yeah, I think that was, well, it's essentially a 10-hour movie. And I think I did 3 hours, which is a pretty high ratio. That's a lot of music.
It's basically 20 minutes for every episode.
It's basically your whole life for like 3 months. I had to make all new friends when I finished that because my social life just atrophied because television is a real different thing.
I just find myself when I see, and the scores, and one of my favorite scores is for Solaris, and I just think of them in terms of rhythm more than anything else, which I think is unusual for somebody I think was being an electronic composer. But the rhythms are really important to you, aren't they?
Yeah, I think it's important to the rhythm of the film. I think that's one of the things that the score can contribute is a sense of pacing and is the film moving quickly or moving slowly. And people have often asked me, what is it that you took from your former career as a rock and roll drummer that you brought into the world of film scoring, and probably sense of rhythm has its benefits in a more mature life.
But I feel that way, and I just end up thinking about some of the electronic scores that have had a lot of music, or films that had a lot of electronic score, and I think about the Tangerine Dream score for Thief, which opens with a six-minute piece of music that's basically a set piece, and you've done a lot of that kind of scoring, haven't you?
Nicholas Refn has kind of, he was the first director I ever worked with that said, give me a 9-minute cue for these 5 scenes. And that happened in Drive. And that was, you know, up until then, I think 4 or 5 minutes the most, because, you know, music kind of turns into linoleum after that, in my opinion, in a film. And then for Neon Demon, he goes, remember that thing we did for Drive? I said, you mean that really long piece of music? He goes, yeah. I think we need something like that again to tie together these 6 scenes. And I looked at it and said, yeah, but in Drive, that was like 9 minutes. You're talking about 17 minutes now? He goes, yeah, whatever. So it gets longer and longer. But I welcome the challenge because to try to keep music interesting for that long and to try to, you know, serve the dramatic functions of the film for that kind of duration is quite a lot of work.
It feels like basically the score you've done over the last 10 years have had a lot of music in them. I think about a movie like Spring Breakers is like basically between the songs and your music is wall-to-wall music in that.
That was like a gigantic music video. And I think I did 50 minutes. I think Skrillex wrote like 30 minutes and then contributed, a half dozen songs. And then on top of that, I think there was another 20 some songs that maybe didn't play in their complete versions. But yeah, it was like a wall-to-wall music video. And usually I don't think that works that well. Usually the music tends to just kind of disappear when it becomes pervasive like that.
Do you think so?
I think so. I mean, you know, John Williams and Spielberg do films that are almost continuous music at times, and that works fine.
And Morricone, who I know is kind of an influence, he did a lot of music too for this.
Yeah, it can work, but I just think the music tends to disappear if it never stops.
And what's so interesting to me too is that you've done scores that basically have been kind of what we're going to think is almost contrapuntal in some ways, basically a contrast to what's on screen. For example, The Nick, and it makes me think about the Morricone score for Fistful of Dollars, which is really the first modern score to a period film.
Well, that particular score is probably the most influential score. It was the first adult film that I saw. My parents took me to the drive-in to see it, and I fell in love with the score. And it was one of the first albums that I ever owned because I loved the music so much. My parents bought it for me. But yeah, I think I learned the idea of contrapuntal scoring or high contrast, ironic scoring through Soderbergh, because he often didn't want to use the music to repeat anything that was obvious and contained in the imagery or the dialogue. And so he'd want something that's a bit of a contrast if he felt you needed music for other reasons, but didn't want to repeat the obvious or use the music to repeat the obvious. So, it was from him I kind of learned the idea of doing something ironic with the music. And The Nick is kind of a great example because, it's 1900 and everybody else is working really hard to lovingly recreate that era. And here I am, doing something that's modern and contemporary.
But it's also got kind of a basis in science, which makes sense for The Nick, doesn't it?
After the fact, a lot of people have told me or written about why the modern electronic approach to the music works, why it's the sense of discovery, why it's the dawn of the Industrial Revolution. And I never thought of any of that stuff, any of those theories while I was doing it. I was just following orders.
And what were your orders on The Nick?
Well, Stephen and I, the last few projects, don't speak much, and it's not because we don't get along. It's just because after 25 years of working together, we probably communicate through mental telepathy a little bit more. But he did send me, I think, three rough cuts of the first three episodes with some temporary music cut into it, and it was all like Spring Breakers and Drive and Contagion and all this electronic stuff.
That you've done.
that happened to be me, which is the first time. He has never, ever done that before. He's never used my music as a reference, probably wisely assuming that that's, kind of getting into musical incest territory. So he sends me these first three episodes with this modern music, which at the time struck me as possibly a bad idea.
Because?
Well, it didn't seem appropriate. It seemed to me like you're trying to recreate a period and the music was fighting that. And as temporary music, some of this stuff, Spring Breakers and Drive, I didn't think worked that well. But mostly it was just the shock of the concept. So I called him up and said, you sure you want to do this? He just said, yeah. That was the end of it. And I think after seeing like two or three episodes with this kind of modern, contemporary electronic music, your mind just accepts it.
Well, I guess I find myself thinking that for The Nick and for Neon Demon and Only God Forgives and Drive, the music works as kind of a heartbeat. It's almost like a pulse, and we can sort of, in rhythm terms, it sort of tells us what we're feeling in really interesting ways.
And I think kind of the pulse and heartbeat thing is something that's so universal that that's one of the things that kind of puts over the acceptance of the music. I think once you do something with the music that helps to universalize the story and satisfies the basic kind of dramatic requirements of the story through the music, then you can take a lot of liberties with the style. I think The Nick was like a great experiment or a great lesson and how true that is. You know, Solaris was another one, too. I originally said to Stephen, I just bought these steel drums from Trinidad. They're sitting in my living room. I'm just dying to shoehorn them into my next...
Steel drums have an enormous amount of tonal range.
Yeah. Yeah, they have, well, in Trinidad, they have orchestras. They have, like, the basses and the baritones and the altos and sopranos, and they can take up the whole, you know, 88-key range of the piano. But initially, I didn't think that was a very good idea.
You think that a lot, don't you, Cliff? That's not a very good idea. I don't know if I should do this, but...
That's why it's worth trying.
But that's kind of a punk ethos, though, isn't it?
Well, I think if you're not actively trying to cultivate a little animosity from somebody, the director, the audience, then you're not being punk rock.
My guest, who apparently likes to stir up a little bit of trouble when he's composing a score, is Cliff Martinez. His newest score for Nicholas Winding Refn is the score for Neon Demon. But again, I just find myself going back to, because it was just on a late night a couple months ago, the Tangerine Dream score for Thief. And I just wonder if Tangerine Dream was kind of a touchstone for you as well.
Well, that has been a reference at least once. I know for Contagion, Stephen referenced not a particular score of Tangerine Dream, just Tangerine Dream in general. And from that, I just took the idea of kind of a retro electronic score. And there's still a lot of that in Contagion. Now, Stephen...
Films of yours in the last 5 years have been kind of anachronistic in that way. I mean, or using electronic music to comment on the movie. For example, the score for Drive is as much commentary on what's happening as it is underscore, isn't it?
Well, I think for that, actually Contagion and Drive came out were released within a week of each other. And both directors were kind of referencing this anachronistic kind of 80s synth stuff. Stephen through mentioning Tangerine Dream, and Nicholas through these songs that he had chosen that were these, I guess, homages to 80s synth pop. And then when both of those films became kind of successful, or to me, they were not, you know, the underground independent things I'm usually known for. The phone started ringing all of a sudden at the ripe old age of 57, people started calling me, and then you get typecast, and then people want more of that kind of thing. So I became kind of the retro 80s synth guy, which I don't mind. That's fine. I mean, composers should be so lucky as to be typecast for anything, you know, the horror guy, the comedy guy. And I just happened to like, you know, that period. I love Tangerine Dream. I love Kraftwerk, Brian Eno.
I can't hear the scores and not think of these scores and not think about Eno.
Yeah.
And the way that he used those scores as a way of, he talks about their rhythms for breathing almost.
Well, I've been getting beat over the head with the music of Brian Eno in temp music ever since Sex, Lies, and Videotape.
No kidding.
And if I ever get to meet him, I'm going to have to light a cigarette for him, I think.
Another punk rock thing to do for somebody. We're going to take a break. We'll be back tomorrow with my guest, Cliff Martinez, whose newest score is Nicholas Winding Refn's Neon Demon. It's the treatment. There's more to come. Stay with us.
Introducing the KCRW donation car, designed to be recycled. This first-of-its-kind vehicle will save you time, space, and hassle by disappearing. Enjoy the luxury and comfort of turning your underused car into a donation worth hundreds, even thousands of dollars. The KCRW donation car, already in your garage, driveway, or on cinder blocks outside your house. Act now at kcrw.com/cars.
This podcast is produced by nonprofit radio station KCRW. Support the podcast you enjoy by donating at kcrw.com/join. And thanks.
Welcome back. I'm back with telepathic artist and composer Cliff Martinez, whose work with Steven Soderbergh and Nicholas Winding Refn, of course, Harmony Korine. His newest score for Refn is the score for Neon Demon. And you'd asked me if I'd seen it during the break, and I have. And I guess one of the things I find myself thinking about is the directors you work with quite often are guys whose films tend to be a little clinical and detached almost, but they're about really intense subjects. And that's got to present a kind of an interesting sort of thing for you to work with, doesn't it?
Normally, it would mean that the music gets a juicier role. I think the more my impulse is when the film is kind of dry and leaves the viewer to kind of interpret for their own. Like Steven's films are very much like that. I think his stuff is often very open-ended, where the reaction that you're supposed to have isn't that clear. And there might be a range of kind of emotional responses that you might have to something are usually a great place for the music to step in and assert an opinion or a direction. Is it sad? Is it happy? Is it melancholy? Is it one way or the other? Steven, however, usually likes to maintain that dramatic ambiguity, even in the music. But, you know, it's hard for music to be, you can't really put one note in front of the other without saying something. So I think because his films, and Refn's as well, are a bit of an art installation in that you can look at it from many different angles, I think it makes the music feel more important. And indeed, I guess it is, because it's the viewer will turn to the music to offer some interpretation. And again, that's really cool. I think, films like Solaris, Neon Demon, Traffic, even though the music may be very simple, it seems like it has a lot more weight than a film where the director is being more dramatically explicit.
Yeah. And it's interesting because these worlds that we're talking about between the Soderbergh films and Refn's films and Harmony's films as well are all these films that sort of say that this stuff could be shocking. And they're also the films that basically aren't telling us to judge the characters. And if we look at Only God Forgives or Neon Demon, we could be very judgmental about these characters.
Well, that's what I mean about trying to use the music to universalize the story. I think we live in a culture where the movies are predominantly about bad people. I mean, a lot of movies are about bad people that aren't at all like us. They're not at all like the people we interact with or our families or our friends. And movies like Neon Demon or Only God Forgives, Drive, I don't know any people that are actually like that.
Thank goodness.
Yeah, which is a good thing. But if they were, we probably wouldn't go to the movies to watch them. So I think the goal is to try to make these stories seem like something that we can relate to. And that's where I think the music needs to, you know, you need to treat these characters with a little bit more humanity than if you knew these people in real life, that they wouldn't deserve that kind of compassion. But I think in order to put the stories across and make it something that every viewer can relate to, I think you kind of have to do that. So, I had to try to color James Franco as like a nice, wholesome fellow.
No small challenge, but I think as these films we're talking about, and certainly Neon Demon falls into this category, if you will, too, is that these are films with sort of shifting points of view because protagonists, or we should say characters, come and go, and at some point we're not quite sure who the protagonist is.
Yes. I think Neon Demon is kind of the beauty of that. And Nicholas and I had a disagreement on that at one point. And I guess I can't talk about it too much. I've gotten my hand slapped because that's a particularly hard film to talk about without giving too much away. But at a certain point, the hero becomes kind of the jerk, and you become, and I tended to root for the bad people, and I think eventually the bad people don't exactly become the good people, but it's confusing. So where you make that shift in the story was something that I think Nicholas probably left somewhat ambiguous, but at a certain point, the music kind of has to choose a side.
Yeah, it just seems to me these movies where there are these large or a number of people kind of coming in and out and different people, let's say, occupying the center of the film, must present a very specific kind of challenge to deal with.
And sometimes I don't get much help from guys like Nicholas. I'll ask him, I'll say, what did you mean when Ryan Gosling sticks his fist inside of Kristen Scott Thomas? And he'd say, what do you think it meant? I said, well, I don't know what it means, but it might be helpful for me to know what you intended. And he said, well, so what do you think it means?
So he never answered it.
So that was the answer. And I just took it to mean, well, okay, it's intended to be a little bit open-ended. That particular film, I think, was some stuff maybe didn't mean anything specifically, but it is meant to challenge and engage your imagination, was what I took that to mean.
Well, my guest who brings musicality to ambiguity is Cliff Martinez. His new film as composer is Nicholas Winding Refn's Neon Demon. It's The Treatment. When you saw that film the first time, when he gave you the cut to look at, what was your feeling about? Because we're talking about this idea of points of view shifting and somebody who seems to be the most decent from the Midwest, literally arriving on a bus into Los Angeles kind of character. It's kind of, you turn Sunset Boulevard into a horror story without giving too much away. That's the film. What was your feeling about when you saw it?
I thought it was I guess it's a rags to riches story or a Star is Born type story that I related to a lot. I mean, I moved out here when I was my early 20s.
From where?
From Columbus, Ohio.
Detroit, Michigan. We're not far away from each
other. Really? Well, I came out here to jump on the pile and to become a rock star. And much like, you know, Neon Demon, beautiful women tried to kill me and eat me. But I never let it discourage me. And look where I am now. Here I am at NPR Studios sitting in a chair.
So you survived the cannibalism. But in seeing the movie, again, and it's that thing we're talking about where the film doesn't tell us who we're to like, who we're not to like, and obviously you're not getting any cues from the filmmakers because I think what they like about bringing you in is that you become a conspirator who doesn't give the audience cues. And the scores feel almost in that way to me conspiratorial.
Well, I mean, you have to choose sides with the people that hired you. And for me, that's always the director. So if he wants to maintain that ambiguity, then you kind of have to go with it.
But we talk about punk. I mean, the sort of prevailing ethos really is just to stir up trouble, just sort of basically break with things, man. Just think about, you know, those weird covers on those first two Chili Peppers albums, the Hank Williams cover or the Meters cover. Now, where'd these come from, for God's sakes?
Well, there's the Sly Stone.
Yeah.
The Meters cover is an interesting story. We were in, I think, Richmond, Virginia, and we were about to drive to New Orleans. And we were always meeting these, like, college DJs who were, like, these intense music scholars that we could learn a lot from. And this kid came up to us and said, I think it's so cool that you guys are into the Meters and you're like paying homage to the Meters, one of the great American, underrated great American funk bands. And we all looked at each other like, a funk band that we've never heard of? And I think we pretended that we just said, yeah, we love the Meters. And he gave us a cassette tape that we just devoured on the trip to New Orleans, and I just fell in love with Ziggy Modalist.
Yeah,
I just thought he was the greatest drummer ever since Drumbo, Captain Beefheart's drummer, since Tony Williams. He was my new favorite drummer, and I thought, we're going to New Orleans. I wonder if I know anybody who might know Ziggy. I made a few phone calls, couldn't find anybody that knew Ziggy. We pull up to the nightclub to do a sound check, and it was called Jimmy's, small, I think like a 400-seat nightclub in New Orleans. I think it's still there. And the marquee says, tonight, Red Hot Chili Peppers and guest artist Zigaboo. And I thought, wow, is that synchronicity or what? So I'm sitting at the bar waiting for our sound check. Somebody taps me on the shoulder. I turn around, and a voice says, I'm Ziggy, and I'm wondering if I could use your drum set tonight so we don't have to, like, change out the drum sets. And I said, oh, yeah, you can have those drums. I'm so happy to meet you. And we became friends after that. He moved to Los Angeles for a little while. We became good buddies, and that night was a great night. John Lurie sat in with us, who was filming Down by Law, and he said, can I sit in with you guys? And we said, yeah, but you're going to have to do the encore with just a sock on. And he accommodated us. And I think, like, Flea and Anthony are like 5'6", and John is like 6'6", or something. So I'll never forget that image of Flea, Anthony, Jack Sherman, and John Lurie on stage with nothing on but socks, and John had a saxophone and was walking back and forth and saying, what key is this in?
That should be the name of your autobiography.
How appropriate, too, as a drummer.
Of course. Where did the Hank Williams cover idea come from? How Do You Love Me? Why Do You Love Me? Where did that come from?
I think I may be mistaken on this. I think it came from Anthony. I think Anthony was hanging out with John Doe of X, and John Doe is like a big champion of, like, roots American music. I think that's where that came from. I could be wrong, but I'm pretty sure Anthony encouraged us to do that song. I think that's where it came from.
Because those covers really almost sort of encompass what you are as a composer. I mean, going from Sly to Hank to the Meters. I mean, that's like, but it's finally, the all these songs sort of about, these songs that they're kind of emotional but don't tell you what they feel about them, and that really is who you are as a composer.
Well, the Chili Peppers never really embraced country music. I mean, the Meters and Sly were kind of part of, you know, their,
but that's strictly speaking,
their musical identity. But
strictly speaking, that's not actually a note for a note Hank cover.
No,
that song. No. it's a Chili Peppers version,
yeah,
of that song.
Yeah, definitely. I think it's one of their I think it's maybe their best cover because it's so atypical of what the original was all about.
Yeah, yeah. And I just feel like the idea of sort of entering these worlds and sort of like bringing people along with you and not knowing what to make of them because you're trying to figure out what's going on at the same time, it's what attracts you to doing movie scores, is it not?
Well, I think that's what music is about, or filmmaking. I like to think that it's a delicate balance of fulfilling an audience's expectations, but also define their expectations often enough that they don't get complacent, but not so often that you just have chaos. So I like to, you know, throw a curveball about 20% of the time with the music, and I think a good story should do the same. It should kind of be familiar, but shake up your expectations often enough to keep you on your toes.
And that's a great point, especially since we're out of time, and if anybody knows about timing, it's a drummer. I can't thank you enough, Cliff. Thanks so much for doing this.
My pleasure. It was really great to be here.
Oh, great to have you. My guest is Cliff Martinez, who's done a bunch of things. His newest score is for the Nicholas Winding Refn film, Neon Demon. Our recording engineer at NPR West is Marcia Caldwell. The show is mixed by Kat Yor. It's edited by Blake Veit, who's associate producer. Why Don't You Love Me? It's The Treatment. To catch up on past episodes of The Treatment, go to kcrw.com or listen on your smartphone with KCRW's mobile apps, or subscribe to the podcast on iTunes, Stitcher, or wherever you listen to podcasts. The Treatment is produced and distributed by KCRW Santa Monica.